Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, spotlight on the Synod of Bishops for the Middle East, which continues for the second week here in the Vatican. We hear from an expert in Muslim-Christian dialogue, from the Anglican representative to the Synod, and from an English bishop who coordinates practical and prayerful support for Christians in the Holy Land. Attentive listening to the hopes and concerns of other Christians and people of other faiths in the Middle East is one of the most important features of the Synod of Bishops, which moves towards its conclusions on Sunday. Over these last few days, participants are hammering out a list of propositions and a concluding message which will be read out to the gathering and made public at the weekend. While the main theme of the two-week meeting has been focused on communion and witness of the different Catholic churches in the region, the complex question of relations with Islam has been at the heart of the discussions, both in the Synod Hall and in the smaller working groups.
It's a fascinating question. You're absolutely right. It really is one of the main strands of the discussion, constantly surfacing again and again in the conversation.
As a professor teaching Christian-Muslim relations at London's Heathrop College, Jesuit Father Damien Howard is one of the experts at this synod. He told me why it's essential to move beyond the myths and stereotypes that we often use to discuss the problems facing the Middle East.
My sense is there are two poles to the problem as it comes up. If you get the conversation going in one particular direction on one day, it will tend to be that Islam is a huge problem and that there are tensions and difficulties, that Christians are persecuted, Christians are marginalized, their dignity is diminished, and all the rest of it. And these are very, very serious problems. And there really are challenges for us to meet there. And I don't know what the solutions are there. But if you listen carefully too, there are an awful lot of moments of clarity about the really good relationships that are possible between Christians and individual Muslims. And I think there is a growing awareness that we've got to be clear in our dealings with Muslims to distinguish between Islam and Muslims. That's to say, Islam, if we're not careful, becomes a kind of abstract, rigid reality. And once we start talking about that, we all get stuck, quite frankly, because we've all had particular experiences of Islam, and we all think we know what it is. And when we get into that logic, I think we get caught. Think more in terms of relationship. Think more in terms of the way that Christians and Muslims live together, and actually the way that Christians and Muslims can recognize genuine goodness, genuine holiness in each other's lives. And then it seems to me you've got the real possibilities for conversation that transforms everybody. And that's my hope, that's what keeps me going, and that's, I think, what I see going on a little bit in my own country.
One of the keys to this would seem to be a much greater education about Islam amongst all the Christian churches, the Catholic Church in particular, there in the region.
Absolutely, that's a key part of it. Just knowing what is a false generalization, what is propaganda, either from certain corners in the West or from certain Muslim areas. You know, this is a very charged and political area. There are a lot of myths flying around with strong political agendas. And I think one of the key things that Christians need to do is to be able to distinguish, and it's not always easy, God knows, you know, between myth and truth. Truth is always complicated and nuanced, and it's not easy to engage with. Sometimes we prefer to stay with propaganda and myth because it makes things easy. But the problem is that's exactly what it's trying to do, and that's the trap we mustn't fall into.
We've heard two Muslim representatives, one from the Sunni and one from the Shia tradition, speaking to the Synod Fathers. What impact do you think this can have, first of all?
Well, first of all, I think it's really important that those voices are heard, that they're part of our deliberations here. For various reasons. One is that it sort of interrupts our own internal conversation and makes us aware that the Muslim voices are, first of all, plural, and they're not always what we think they are. I think a lot of people were very impressed by Mr. Samak and his, I think, quite keenly political ear for the problems that Christians are going through. He didn't have any easy solutions, but I think people felt that he did understand a little bit the situation of great suffering and distress that a lot of Christians are facing in the region. I think we also heard something of the troubles of his own community. Because I think one of the dangers we can fall into, and this is in all our countries, is that somehow we are unique in our suffering and our distress. And I think we need to remember that Muslims also feel their distress, and we need to hear and understand that.
One of the key questions, of course, is the issue of freedom of conscience within the Muslim context. And Mr. Samak made some interesting remarks about the way conversion is seen as somehow betraying the state, an act of treason.
Well, I mean, that's I think, the mentality that it's coming from. The question is, well, what do we do in the modern context where, increasingly, whether we like it or not, and as a Westerner I must say I do like it, freedom of conscience is an important way that we understand human dignity. It's an important component of our human dignity. And I really don't think there's any future in an Islam that refuses to recognise that. And I think Muslims in very many parts of the world already accept that and see that. There are certain regimes in the world where that's not acknowledged. My sense is that as time moves on, through conversation and dialogue and just the way that things change, generations change, that will change too. That's my hope.
Heythrop College, though, is very much a leader in this field of trying to promote a really genuine dialogue between the Catholic Church and the different strands of Islam. What would you say, perhaps, if you had to sort of point to some kind of success that you have there in the work you do, or what gives you most hope in this sense?
Well, for instance, one of the things I'm not doing this week because I'm away here in Rome is teaching a group of young undergraduates, mostly Muslims, but also Jews and Sikhs and various other people, about Christianity. That's an astonishing truth. I don't want to exaggerate its value, but it's an important aspect of what I would call a genuine dialogue and encounter between Christians and people of other faith in a country where pluralism is very real, but also can sometimes pass for a kind of indifferentism. Muslims, on the whole, think they understand what Christianity is because the Quran gives them a picture of Christianity. So one of the first things that we have to do is say, okay, well, if you want to believe that and you want to adhere to that kind of narrative, well, fine. But in this place, I'm going to have to tell you that Christianity is something very different from what you think. What you do with the tension between the two is up to you as a Muslim. But this is how Christians understand themselves. And that's a very interesting and exciting process. And I think once it gets going, you actually get some very interesting results, very interesting conversations going on.
It's also a drop in the ocean in a way, isn't it? These areas where, if you like, intellectual dialogue does go on between people of different faiths. How do you, in some ways, spread this mentality out amongst the general population? It's much harder to do that, isn't it?
Well, of course. I mean, what great revolution in the history of the world doesn't start as a drop in the ocean? You know, individuals talking among themselves, beginning to awaken a new kind of conscience. I think if we tell ourselves that it's a mere drop in the ocean, then we get very defeatist very quickly. I don't look at what I'm doing and think of it as a sort of an operation in an ivory tower. It doesn't feel like that. It feels like very ordinary people who are going to go back into their communities and talk in a different way. And that's very powerful. It may be very simple, but it's very powerful. And if it starts in a small way, well, that's what the Lord said the kingdom is like. It starts very small and great things can come of it. So I don't find that problematic.
My thanks there to Jesuit Father Damien Howard, a professor of Christian-Muslim relations at London's Heythrop College. The Anglican representative to the Middle East Synod, Bishop Michael Langrish, says the Church of England is committed to helping the UK government, society and media to more fully understand and face up to the consequences of foreign policy decisions over the past 100 years. The bishop, who travels regularly throughout the region, said during the Second Iraq War, both the Catholic and Church of England bishops were at the forefront of questioning not only the morality of the war, but also its ongoing impact. I caught up with Bishop Michael just after a meeting with Pope Benedict and the other ecumenical delegates at this synod. I began by asking him about his own connections to the Middle East that have brought him here to this synod in the Vatican.
I always say that my connections began before I was born. My father was a professional soldier, and he was stationed in the Holy Land in the 1930s with the Mandate Forces in Palestine. And I grew up with his stories of that period, which I think, you know, had a very strong impact on me, of the way in which the Mandate Forces were dealing with both the emergent Jewish nationalism and terrorism on both sides. And I suppose from an early age it took me into wanting to know more about the region.
It's an interesting perspective because, as you say, so many of today's problems date right back to that period, don't they?
I have absolutely no doubt at all that Western interventions by both church and state for the last 100 years have done a great deal to shape and continues to shape the Middle East today. And I think one of the things that concerns me is how very difficult it is to get a clear realisation about this, certainly in the UK, but I think more generally in the West, and to get some mature conversation about our responsibilities in the light of that history.
Do you see that as part of the responsibility of the church leaders to be able to advocate with governments to really put this issue at the top of the agenda?
I think it's actually hugely important. I mean, there have been times that when we have tried to do so, for example, during the Second Iraq War, the bishops, both the Catholic bishops and the Church of England bishops, were, I think, at the forefront of questioning not only the morality of the war, and I remain convinced that it did not satisfy any just war criteria, but also the ongoing impact. And one of the impacts we've seen, and there's been a huge, huge impact of both the first and the second Iraq wars on the Christian community in Iraq, that is still not sufficiently acknowledged, and the consequences being dealt with.
From what I've been hearing here, particularly also from the Muslim and Jewish representatives, the problems facing the Christians in some sense are problems facing all people in that region today.
That's true in some senses. Although there are commonalities across the region, it is also clear that the position of Christians and indeed of different Muslim groups is very different from state to state, nation to nation. So whilst, yes, there are certain places where the circumstances in which they live are shared, in other circumstances, no. Because one of the questions I found myself asking when I came back from my very first visit to the Middle East, let's say over 30 years ago, was who are the minority and who are the majority? It's a question that's almost impossible to ask, because in almost every situation, almost every community can, with a certain justification, see themselves as a part of an oppressed minority, but also as belonging to what by minorities is seen as a larger and powerful majority. And that's part of the complexity of the Middle East.
There's very much this complex question, the psychological identity with a victim in the region, isn't there?
I think very much so, and certainly in our small group earlier this week, one of the interesting topics onto which we got quite quickly were the conditions that make for what we were talking about as the psychology of peace. You can only go so far with political initiatives, but unless you're working with the socio-cultural heritage that forms the psychology of individuals and communities, I begin to address the deep fears, as well as the aspirations, that shape that psychology, you won't get very far. But one of the things that brings me to Rome most frequently is a connection with the community of Sant'Egidio. There's much about that community that draws me strongly, but not least, they have a very real grasp of this psychological dimension of peacemaking, and we've seen it from Africa right the way through to the Middle East, the way in which they have tried to draw people together in attentive listening to one another so that they began to hear what is being said behind the overt words that reflect, as I say, this deep psychology. I suppose one of the things that really encourages me about this synod is that hopefully it will encourage the same kind of attentive listening to one another among the various people who are gathered here.
Your presence here underlines the need for greater ecumenical cooperation, and yet the Synod has been discussing the difficulties of cooperation even amongst the Catholic rites in the region. It's a bit unrealistic, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, certainly from our own point of view, one of the things that I think is tragic is that in our own ecumenical dialogue between Anglicans and Roman Catholics, the Roman Catholic side has been represented almost entirely by Western Latin Catholics, and there's been very, very little engagement on the part of the Eastern Catholics. We definitely, desperately need that input, even at a time when our dialogue is perhaps a little fragile, but it needs to go alongside the robust dialogue that we have with the Orthodox. But here within this synod, I have found it heartening that certain themes are coming up over and over again. One is the need for really strong formation of the laity and a much more serious commitment of resources to that. But then the second is the need to address the fractured nature of the church in the Middle East, which constantly compromises and undermines its witness. In fact, it is a scandal to the twin themes of this synod, which are how to live as communion and as united witness. And it's been good to hear both from fraternal delegates but also from within the Eastern churches themselves a call for ways, finding ways for a far greater unity. Now, of course, words are easy, action more difficult, and all that we've just been saying about the psychology of peacemaking is to be found there. There is a psychology of ecumenical dialogue, there's a psychology of internal communion dialogue as well.
You've obviously got a lot of ideas that you'll be taking back home with you from this synod. What, in a nutshell, is your message to the synod fathers here?
Gosh, it would be difficult to boil it down to a single message. If I were allowed, say, three, one would be as part of that formation of laity and clergy. I think there is a need for a deep re-engagement with Scripture as the Word of God. As I travel around the Middle East, and particularly in the Holy Land, but not just in the Holy Land, I detect a deep disengagement, particularly from parts of the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, where there's a feeling that narratives have been used to justify an oppressive ideology. Now, unless there is actually a deep re-engagement with the whole of Scripture as the living Word of God, I think Christians will not be equipped to play their part in the dialogue of which we've been talking. I think there is, secondly, this desperate issue of finding ways in which Christians can live in greater unity, overcoming what is at worst a living in a kind of separate ghettos, but at worst, taken Jerusalem, where they often seem to be in a state of hostility to one another. And I think the third is this: the importance of us in the West continuing to act as advocates for the Christian communities and the Christian story. And one of the things I hear Christians in the Middle East saying to me constantly is, Bishop, don't present us our story as the story of people who are a problem. We are not a problem. We have a long and honourable tradition of presence in this land, and our presence is important not only for the church here, for the church worldwide. And that is absolutely the case. And the decline in the number of Christians would be disastrous for the world church, losing touch with that very essence of incarnation which is at the heart of our faith, and also that centuries-long engagement with the world of Islam, which we in the West are only just falteringly finding our way forwards to. So certainly as I go back to the UK, I will be wanting to talk to my own Archbishop about what we can do in terms of further advocacy, visits, exchange, so that we continually raise the profile of that important narrative.
Finally, you've just met with Pope Benedict, haven't you? Can you tell us anything about his message to you?
Well, of course, it's actually the third time within a month, actually, that I've had the privilege of meeting him. And on the first occasion, we just touched on his memorable visit to the UK. I mean, I think he is a remarkable person. He holds within himself the kind of attentive listening that I was talking about. And certainly, you saw it particularly in Westminster Hall in London, his ability to listen to the nuances of British society and then speak to them from within the depth of the Christian tradition was very, very evident. He and the Archbishop had a good personal conversation about the needs of the Middle East. We've just touched on that now. I'm full of hope that Lambeth and the Vatican together might work towards a new and rather different initiative to see ways in which we can, as I say, engage in this raising of the profile, but particularly from within the historic responsibilities of a country like the UK.
Are you talking about setting up a special body to do just that?
Well, I think it might begin with actually not a large conference, which generally tends to produce reports of words, but actually a smaller body, comprising largely of those from within the region, to talk about programmes of action. For myself, one of the really important things is continual engagement, breaking down the barriers of ignorance which so afflict the Western Church and actually lead to deeply ill-informed actions on the part of certain sects, denominations and strands within contemporary Christian theology.
thanks there to Bishop Michael Langrish of Exeter, the Anglican representative to this Middle East Synod of Bishops. Among the many events organised on the sidelines of the Synod over these 2 weeks was a meeting of the so-called coordination of bishops from Europe and North America in support of Catholics in the Holy Land. Bishop Bill Kenny is auxiliary of Birmingham in central England and moderator of this group, which makes a high-profile pilgrimage at least once a year, meeting with both political and church leaders, as well as visiting parishes and church-run education, health or charity projects across the region. After the meeting, Bishop Kenny dropped by our studios to tell me more about the origins and aims of this organisation.
It's an initiative of the Holy See itself. There was a meeting in 1998, and out of that grew one or two initiatives. One of them was to gather together a group of bishops from countries who either now have or historically have had a connection with what is now Israel, Palestine. And it basically is the United States, Canada, and quite a large number of the bishops' conferences in Western Europe.
And the aims of the organisation?
The aim of the organisation is, first of all, to support the bishops in the Holy Land, but also to support the Catholics there. It is not for financial help, it is for moral support, but also therefore that when we come back, and therefore we need to learn things while we are there, to talk to our own governments, to talk to the Israeli ambassadors in our countries, these sort of things as well.
Moral support is quite difficult to measure, isn't it? What do you feel you've achieved perhaps over this past decade?
I think we've achieved quite a lot. I think one of the things that is more quantifiable, that is moral support, is I, some years ago, formulated that it was three P's that we had to do. And that was prayer, pilgrimage and propaganda, in that order. Prayer, of course, we can't judge, but some countries have begun campaigns of prayer. But what we've definitely succeeded with is the pilgrimage. And many, many of the countries we represent have begun pilgrimages, not least because the bishops have been there, have said this is what is necessary. So that is definitely a more quantifiable success that we have had. Whether we propaganda, we have anything, we're not politicians, let's be honest. And so we are attempting always to give other information than what is given in the mass media, particularly about the human situation of people in Gaza because of the wall. But what we must do is to give hope. It's not just about talking about the misery that is there and that is there, but that will never be solved in itself. We have to try and find signs of hope.
You are involved, aren't you, in talks with government politicians back in your own countries. What do you do in this regard exactly?
We try to say to our own politicians, say in the United Kingdom, that we've been there, what we see, what we know. We can therefore sometimes, if they seem to us to have wrong information, to question that. We do not try to dictate policy. That is not our job. But we do try to spread information. And also not just, of course, to ministers, but also to parliamentarians and to groups within Parliament who would be interested. And that means that they, in their turn, often can ask ministers the right sort of questions, which is galvanising an opinion, which we hope will lead to a just peace, both for Israel and for Palestine.
You're, of course, working very closely with the Catholic Church, but that's just one of 13 Christian churches there in the region, isn't it?
It is.
Could you work more closely, do you think, with others over these, as you say, crucial issues?
I think we do to some extent. There's certainly a certain amount of cooperation. I'm talking now for the United Kingdom with the Anglican Church. Archbishop Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, has become very interested in the plight of the Christians in the Middle East, and we certainly will be working with him in the future. There's an awful lot of work goes on which perhaps doesn't always get any publicity, and perhaps we don't always even want publicity, where the churches do work together on many of these issues. So it'd be wrong to say nothing is happening even together. I can't say we're doing it with all 13, but let's just talk about the Anglicans, which is our nearest neighbours.
It's a start in the right direction. How much do you think people in Britain are supportive of this particular cause? I mean, there has been a lot of prejudice over both Israel and the Palestinian people, hasn't there?
It has. I don't think people are very aware of what is going on. That's my honest opinion. They become aware when there's violence one way or the other. We remember the Israeli storming of the boats going in with aid to Gaza. We hear about rockets being fired into Israel from Gaza. But a real analysis outside of the very serious newspapers, there is no serious analysis of why these things are going on or what is happening. And I think many people will be quite shocked at the details of how ordinary people are affected by many of these measures. But as I say, what we were trying to do is not just to tell about that, but to try and get people to see that they must mix with one another. One of the most depressing signs I know in all of Israel is as you go across the border into Bethlehem, there is a sign which says, I may not have got it exactly what it says, but it is basically says that Israeli citizens are not permitted to proceed beyond this point. And that I find utterly depressing, because I honestly believe that if you put people together and get them to talk, they will find much, much more that binds them together than they will ever find to separate them. And that, for me, is the mistake of the policies in the Middle East. It's splitting people up rather than putting them together.
It continues to be quite a negative picture, doesn't it? You go back year after year, and yet again the peace talks right now are stalled. It doesn't seem to be very much hope to hang on to from a superficial reading of the situation.
I'd agree with you if it's only politics you're interested in. I honestly believe in people, and I think there's lots of hope. Talk to the young people in, say, Bethlehem University or in the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and they would love to be able to mix with the other teenagers, young men and women in the respective countries. They dream of that, both sides. There are lots of people who would do that. Yes, if you're going to keep to the political situation, I agree with you, it's very depressing. If you begin to talk to real people who have real lives, sorry, I don't mean that politicians don't have real lives, but if you begin to talk to people with real lives, then you begin to find there's hope.
It's often said that religions are such a key part of this conflict over land there in Palestine and in Israel that they can't be part of the solution in any way. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. I agree that the land can be a part of the problem, and I agree that we've got to find solutions to that. But surely it's not beyond the ingenuity of human beings to find a solution to be able to live together. I have a suspicion we listen far too frequently to the extremists or to the people who, for whatever reasons, want trouble or want split. Let's try and listen to the ordinary married people, to the ordinary girls and boys looking for a partner, looking for a career, looking for a job, looking for a future. There's real hope there.
You're here as the Synod of Bishops is going on in the Vatican. What do you think can come out of this? Can there be any expectations that it can perhaps in some way contribute to this process, as you say, of finding a lasting peace?
I would like to hope that it can, and I would like to. I think many bishops would want to tell their story. And that is always the beginning of any bringing together of people. Now, you might say, well, the bishops are all together. But that's not quite true. The Middle East is quite a variegated place. I mean, remember, we've got Egyptians there and people from Turkey. We've got people coming from Iran, which is not an Arab country, and all of the other Arab countries. You've got all sorts of mixtures going on. And so I think that part of listening to the story will be part of this synod. People say, well, that doesn't produce anything. Again, I don't agree. I think it produces an awful lot, because if people really do listen to the other person's story, they begin to understand. Nearly all of us, including myself, like talking about ourselves. And that is a God-given gift. I don't find that as being selfish, provided I'm also prepared to listen to the other person's story, because each of us is unique. Each of us is made in the image and likeness of God, and therefore the story must be worth telling, because if you tell me your story, I'm hearing something about Almighty God.
You're back to Jerusalem in January again, aren't you? For another,
I'll be there before then. I have a pilgrimage in November with the Aid to the Church in Need, and I will be back in January, though, with the coordination, yes.
Can you give us any kind of preview as to what might be on the programme?
Only in the sense that we are taking up this, we're taking seriously now the business of hope, and so we will be trying to put young people together and talk to them. We obviously have got to listen to politicians, we obviously have got to listen to the church leaders on that, but that will probably be part of the programme.
Thanks there to Bishop William Kenny, Auxiliary of Birmingham in the United Kingdom and moderator of the coordinating group in support of Catholics in the Holy Land. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Don't forget, you can follow all our news and feature programmes on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudetur Jesus Christus.